at this. The basic basic pattern that Whitman articulates that I hoped you'd understand is, on the one hand, a development, or as he would say, an evolution of individual consciousness, but that that development is expressed externally. So if we were all a bunch of psychoanalysts in training in this class, the internal side would be what's important. But we're not. This is a class on religious studies. So what's important is the external expression. And Whitmont's argument, Whitmont's point of view, is that all the stuff that falls under the general rubric of religion, all those rituals, stories, myths, acts of worship, so on and so forth, all of those things are collective ways of expressing something that's been going on in the collection of individual minds. And as those individual minds are developing over time, that external expression changes over time. Now, the other thing that he articulates is a certain degree of conflict between the external and the internal, which I'll come back to. The main theme that he worked with, he talks about the imaginal phase or the mythological phase. And in that, he talked very extensively about the suppression of the feminine and the rise of masculine consciousness and then the splitting in masculine consciousness. So I want to go back to that a bit and see if I can clarify some features of that for everyone and indicate why it's so important. And I want to connect that with Bly's article, I Came from the Mother Naked, but I usually call it The Four Faces of the Mother, because that's what he talks about, the four aspects of the feminine, he says the mother. And I also want to connect that with Campbell's article that you'll be reading on the hero and the hero's journey. And in fact, if you could read the first 30 pages of that, which is a PDF, before tomorrow, that would be good. If you can't, you can't, but it would be useful to read it before tomorrow's talk. Now, the thing, to go back to this mythological phase that Whitmont articulates. And stop me if you have questions. I want to talk about something. But to go back to this mythological phase that Whitmont articulates, the important thing to understand is that from the beginning of this period of time to the end of this period of time, and the beginning of this period of time is a couple 3,000 BC, to the end of this time, which is probably a couple hundred years AD, post-Christ, actually, okay, post-Jesus. From the beginning of this time to the end of this time, there's a developmental process that's going on. Cultures are changing, right? So we're looking at a change from the beginnings of agricultural society, and in particular, the beginnings of metal tool usage, Bronze Age, using of bronze, to the rise of using of iron. There's big cultural changes that are happening in the world during this period of time. And they're reflected in the way in which people understand the world. The way they understand the world is through these mythological images. They're through the stories they tell about what's going on in the world. Now, in the archaic period, the magical period, and in fact in the very early mythic period, although we don't know a lot about it because we don't really have the stories intact, but we do have images, and we can interpolate by looking at the stories what was going on in the earliest levels. In the very beginning, it was understood that the cosmos has masculine and feminine aspects, because I mean, basically what people are doing is they're projecting themselves, if you will, into the world. You know, even in the ancient world, they're male and female people, right? And people are looking at existence, and they're looking at existence and understanding it from the point of view of their own experience, both as adults and children. So children are dependent upon the mother I mean, one of the earliest things that children understand is their relationship to the mother. And so the hypothesis is that level of understanding of one's relationship with the mother gets writ large, if you will, and that's one's relationship with the world. That the world is like a mother, takes care of one like a mother, but has also what we would consider now negative aspects, which have to do with death, the return to the mother, right? Which is kind of scary for us, but apparently was less scary for people who had a different kind of relationship with the world understood as being maternal. We don't understand the world as maternal, right? And in fact, as Whitmont points out, especially as he talks about the mental phase, you know, which is associated with the rise of the independent ego, everything that's associated with the mother becomes a little scary in the sense of ego as individual arises out of the large context of the feminine, of the mother, of the earth. And that quality of independence is hard won. It's an achievement, but the danger is absorption into the whole. I mean, you can think about this politically, and it's very interesting because there are many political movements that are predicated on the idea of losing individual responsibility, that individual responsibility is an achievement and there's a weight to it, and in some respect we like to lose it. Think about drinking parties. I mean, you go through the week, work, be in control of your environment, do what the boss says, do the homework, listen to this pain in the ass professor who makes you read 30 pages of Joseph Campbell or whatever you have to do when you'd rather be playing magic or whatever. It's like, and at the end of the week, it's sort of, I had enough of that. You know, give me a break. And you get intoxicated. This is actually a very standard and normal kind of thing. Why? It's like the quality of independence and separateness is weighty. And so you want to lose it a little bit. You know, let's go dancing and we'll forget ourselves. Let's forget our troubles. You know, we'll drink a little, we'll go dancing. We'll forget all this hassle of ordinary life. This is like a return to the mother, and there's an ambivalence about it, because if you go too far in that direction and you lose your sense of control and independence, you can't necessarily come back. And this is one of the things that Bly talks about, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. So anyway, during the mythological period, right, this whole quality of the world as being feminine, like a mother, begins to be suppressed and dissipated. And the reason for this is you have nomadic cultures, you have warrior-based cultures, which are prizing conquest. They're prizing a certain type of individuality. They're prizing conflict. Right? These are all positive values in these cultures, which are opposed to all the values that the feminine is associated with. So these values are suppressed, they're lost, and the kind of spirituality of these people is the spirituality of more like the Native Americans of the plains. I'm not saying that they're like the ancient nomadic peoples of the past, but this sort of quality of independence and warlike nature that they have. It's very different than the sort of matricentric quality of the early agricultural societies. Along with the suppression of the feminine, which is then, when it's suppressed in the individual consciousness, it's suppressed in the consciousness of all the individuals, it disappears from the external projection. So if you don't experience it internally, you certainly don't see it in the world around you. So the goddess begins to disappear or transform in myth, which is to say the qualities of the goddess that are in the world begin to disappear. But what remains, because you have these nomadic and more warlike societies, is the masculine aspect of the mythology that was associated with the goddess, but it also has to change. So the original form of the masculine aspect, you had sun and moon type images. I mean, they could be lion, they could be birds, they could be snakes, they could be bulls. It doesn't really matter. But one easy way to understand this is solar imagery and lunar imagery. If you think about what people's life is on the planet, before electricity certainly, it's dominated in the 24-hour cycle by what's happening with the sun and the moon. When the sun comes up, you're outside, you're doing various kinds of things, but when the sun goes down and it's dark, the world changes. And if there's no moon at all, it's a real scary place because you can't see anything that's going on, right? When the moon is full, you can sort of see what's going on. It's not quite so scary. So the characteristics of day and night really control people's lives in a way that's very hard for us to recollect because we're so disconnected from that, not just because of the way we live physically, but because of electricity and light and the way we organize our time. Very different way in the past, okay? So if we think about the issues in terms of solar and lunar, the companions of the goddess were typically solar-type mythic images or deities and lunar-type mythic images or deities. Now, it's not like the goddess herself didn't have those characteristics, but when she's suppressed, those qualities disappear, but they remain with her consort, okay? But as time goes on, during the mythic period, according to this hypothesis, there's a favoring of the solar over the lunar. And this is the big thing about Apollo and Dionysus. Apollo, to use the Greek form of this issue, Apollo is solar, Dionysus is lunar, right? Those are the companions, sun and moon. Those are the companions of the goddess, who's the great space, if you will. So you have the sun and the moon and the earth. The goddess is the great space, is the earth, and then you have the sun and the moon, which isn't to say that the goddess isn't also those things, but that makes things more complicated. Let's simplify it for a moment. The nomadic and more warlike societies end up prizing the solar over the lunar for all kinds of reasons. Okay, the patriarchal societies prize the solar over the lunar for a whole variety of reasons. So all the aspects of myth that are associated with the lunar, those also become suppressed because the values and the personal qualities that are associated that with nature of consciousness and that type of social organization and those values, those things are suppressed also. Lunar is about change. The lunar cycle is all about change. The lunar cycle is about darkness. The lunar cycle is about what's hidden. Okay. The solar is about what's out there. It's about what's seen. Anyhow, in time, Apollo and Dionysus separate, and where they were originally brothers, they're now sort of in conflict. Right? Now, if you think, there are a lot of stories about heroic brothers. I mean, we've talked about the series on television. I've forgotten the name of it now.
Supernatural?
Yes, Supernatural. Two brothers, but they have different characteristics. In Supernatural, one brother is sort of like the good brother. He's kind of interested in family and stuff like that. The other brother is always getting himself in trouble. He goes to hell. He drinks dragon's blood, all that kind of stuff, right? This is actually not an unusual type of story in myth where you have two brothers who have very different kinds of characteristics. So originally, sun and moon, Apollo and Dionysus are like brothers, but they separate. And all the things that are associated with Dionysus are troubling to the patriarchy because they have to do with chaos, they have to do with darkness, they have to do with intoxication, they have to do with generation, all these kinds of things, okay? All the stuff, and so by the way, that particular brother in Bewitched is the one that goes to hell. I don't remember what his name is, but he's the one who's always creating problems. He's the one who's also the genius, right? He starts out at Stanford. He's going to get a full ride to law school. He's the unusual brother. He's not the typical normative brother. But he's also the one that gets in all the trouble, also because of all that stuff. But that's a different aspect of things. Yeah?
Well, he went to hell, too.
Did the good brother go to hell, too?
Yeah.
All right, strike everything I just said. Okay.
He brought Sam back to life.
He had to go to hell to bring Sam back to life.
No, he sold his soul. And then
the good brother sold his soul?
Mm-hmm. He sold his soul to Asriel, and then he brought Sam back to life.
Oh, well, it's Hollywood. I should never use Hollywood to illustrate anything. I'm gonna edit this out of this recording. Because they're making this stuff up as they go. We can't read too much into it, but I thought it might be a good illustration.
Sorry.
Guess not. That's okay.
Sure.
It's all right.
The show.
Anyhow, the main thing is that there is a separation over time between Apollo and Dionysus. If we look at the story of Theseus and the Minotaur, we're looking at this story again where Theseus is like the Apollonian and the Minotaur, or Ariadne, is like the Dionysian, right? And there's a conflict between the two of them. When we looked at the image of Mithra slaying the bull, we see it real clearly. Mithra is sitting on top of the bull, stabbing him in the neck. He's sacrificing the bull. He's sacrificing the Dionysian lunar quality that's associated with the bull, and the solar is coming out on top, is rising. Well, Mithraism was very popular with the Roman legions, not so popular in the rest of the Roman world, very popular among the Roman soldiers. In other parts of the world, the Christian myth story, religion, was more popular. Not so much in the army, though, which is interesting. Okay. So anyhow, you have this division that's going on. Now, the reason that this is important religiously is, among other reasons, when you get to the time of Christ, you have a very interesting phenomenon. Because if you look at the story of Christ and you set aside, did he live or did he not live? Is this literally true or is this a story? Is this a myth? Jesus, or Christ, is a very typical example of one of the companions of the great goddess who rises, achieves something, comes to maturity, and is sacrificed so that he can be reborn. This is the myth over and over again, where the god rises, performs some activities, whatever they may be, and in the end has to be sacrificed so that the god can be reborn. This is the recurring cycle of things. Okay. This story is attached to Jesus. So Jesus may have lived, and he may have gone through all the elements of the story that are in the Bible. There may have been a Jesus, and he may have been crucified. And for all I know, he may have actually risen from the dead. I have no idea, right? But in a sense, it doesn't make any difference, because the story, the myth attached to him, just as there was a various other type individuals in the Roman world, the story attached to him, right? And the power of the story, therefore, is amplified, and an entire religion can be built around the story. Now, if you want to think about this in perhaps the most profound way, because I don't want to I don't want to challenge anybody's faith by saying this. One of the ways you can read the story is to say Jesus knew exactly what was going on. And he knew that the story was going to get attached to him, that the myth of the dying and resurrected God was going to get attached to him. So he willingly enacted the story so that it could get attached to him, so that it would have potency in the life of the people around him. And that's a very interesting way to read the story of, I think it's at Gethsemane, when he goes off to pray and he leaves the disciples behind and he says, Lord, can this cup pass from me? And the message he gets from God is no. You are the sacrifice. You will be crucified. You do not have any choice in this matter. Well, probably you do. You don't have to if you don't want to. But I want you to. Are you going to be obedient? And Jesus basically says, okay, I'm going to do it. I will allow myself to be sacrificed in this way. So you could say that here is a spiritual person, a saintly person, a divine person, however you want to read it, who says, I'll allow this myth to be attached to me because it's going to be beneficial to people. And so then there's no difference between the life of Jesus and the myth. So I'm not going to say it's one way or the other, but I don't want to, in a class like this, undermine anybody's faith. And to me, this is a way of bringing the two things together. But be that as it may, the myth did exist in that part of the world about the dying and resurrected God, right? And what happened, though, is in the context of this myth and the way the Christians in particular took it, with the idea that there's one resurrection and not a sequence of resurrections year by year by year, which was the Dionysian story. Okay, the Dionysian story was Dionysus is constantly dying and being reborn. Okay, so Jesus dies once and is reborn, and then everybody's saved by that one rebirth, and they don't have to go through that process themselves over and over again, which is one of the reasons reincarnation was thrown out by the Christian church, because you don't want to go through that process over and over again. Okay, so the consequence of this, though, is the splitting reaches its maximum degree, and now what you have happening is you have Jesus actually becoming, or Christ becoming, the solar deity. And what was Dionysus, which was the lunar deity, which was his brother, now becomes Satan. And there's very clear evidence for the way Satan is the Christian representation of the Dionysian qualities, or the lunar qualities. So now, solar and lunar completely split. Solar is associated with good, and lunar is associated with evil. And all the stuff with the horns of the moon, the horns of Satan, all this kind of stuff, becomes even farther pushed out of consciousness, because how can you have any devilish qualities yourself? You can't possibly. You know, those things are all pushed out of your consciousness and pushed out of society. Okay. So you have not just the feminine that's repressed, but now the Dionysian and everything that's associated with the lunar, including intoxication, by the way. Right? So one view is the need to be intoxicated is merely human. People can only take so much sobriety and self-control. They need to let it out. You've got to have Mardi Gras. You've got to go down to hide out on Friday night. You've got to go to the dance. I mean, whatever the case may be. You know, in my case, it's much more sitting down and watching television and eating popcorn with a lot of butter on it. But it comes to the same thing. It's a way of sort of disconnecting from the mundane. People need it, but that's now been removed from what's acceptable, except under very limited circumstances, like Mardi Gras. Yeah?
Is it kind of like all work and no play?
All work and no play. Boring, 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 boring. Right? Because, yeah, play, so we're not even talking about that. Play, which is an attribute of children, right, who are now growing up and becoming self-controlled, like, you can't play anymore. That's what children do. Adults can't play. You can't have that kind of fun anymore. That's not allowed. So if you're in your like late teens, you really see that discrepancy between the loss of childhood and the coming of adulthood. And any human being in that situation who has their head screwed on even a little bit straight will not be happy about losing that childlike quality in themselves and the ability to play and the valuation of play, which actually turns out from a social point of view to be a stupid version of repression, because there's so much creative stuff that comes out of play that gets lost. Just like there's a lot of creative stuff that comes out of certain kinds of intoxication that gets lost. That gets us back to Bly, to go in that direction. Okay. So that's the maximal split now between solar and lunar, God and the devil. And that's why this stuff becomes relevant, because this is a very interesting way to read what's going on in Christianity. Because you have these images and you have these meanings overlaid on the images, and the mythic meaning is what drives emotionality. Okay. So now, let's go back to this other feature of what Whitmont was talking about. At one point he says, what is mythic and understood by the society in a sense is conscious in that society, but in earlier times was the unconscious of the society. Remember this? He talks a lot about the way in which what's unconscious in the collective gets projected, but is, although it's out there, you're not aware of it, and as, or not fully aware of it, and as your awareness of it grows and it gets worked out in the form of new stories and new myths, and that becomes established, and that people become conscious of it, then there's something new in the unconscious. So there's this kind of process that's going on. So if we crank forward to, say, the modern period now, okay, the main myth that's out there that people are conscious of is not the myth of Jesus dying and being reborn. That's the old myth. The myth that people are conscious of now that engages everybody's attention is the heroic myth. And that's what Campbell's going to be talking about. And the reason I can say the main thing that's out there that engages people's attention is the heroic myth is all you have to do is turn on the television or go to the movies. That's all you see is the heroic myth over and over and over and over again. Now, I'm not saying there's something wrong with the heroic myth. I'm just saying that that's the main story that's out there, and that's what Campbell writes about. Now, Campbell will say that it's the main myth, that it exists in all societies and so on and so forth. Well, that's true, but he's ignoring the fact that there were other types of myth that were earlier. So we have to take that particular statement of his with a little bit of a grain of salt. So the heroic myth is what we're all aware of. It's like, I'm going to volunteer for the military and go to Afghanistan and save democracy. Or I'm going to be a hunter, to use that example. And hunter is an interesting word that they use in the series Supernatural. They're hunters. Hunters, right? Hunters are like the nomadic types or the warrior types. They're hunters. But what are they hunting? They're hunting evil. They're conquering evil. They're suppressing evil. They're heroic. They're heroic figures. Or go back to The Wizard of Oz. Dorothy is a heroic figure. A young woman, or girl, or teenager, but she's a heroic figure. She goes on a heroic journey. She has evils to overcome. She has problems to solve. She has mysteries to unravel. All these things that are associated with the heroic story. But we have a woman. So the heroic myth is not only a story about men. Women can be heroes. And it's not only about adults. Teenagers and children can be heroes. The heroic myth fits all. And Campbell really explored this in great detail. But if the heroic myth is what's out there and popular in the collective conscious mind, then what's going on in the collective unconscious mind? That's what Bly is talking about. And when Whitman talks about the return of the goddess, they're all saying that something that's very unusual that started happening in the 20th century was the repressed feminine, repressed 3,000-4,000 years ago, is coming back. Now, one way of understanding that is that human beings are integrating themselves. And I'll talk about integration or completeness a little bit later. But whatever the case may be, these people are saying feminine spiritual is coming back, right? That Dan Brown could make a big pile of money on the Da Vinci Code, and then he makes another big pile of money writing about the spiritual feminine. I don't remember what his book was called anymore. But it was a New York Times bestseller. He got filthy rich on that one, too. You can't write books that make it to the New York Times bestseller list and make a pile of money unless they're resonating with something that's in the collective mind. And I say collective mind because a whole lot of people have to buy the book for him to make that much money and sell that many copies to get to the New York Times bestseller list. So this is an interesting litmus, an interesting barometer, if you will, of something cultural. Yeah. Is that the one? Angels and Demons? Is that what it was called? I don't remember what it was called. I saw the movie or skimmed the book. It was pretty crappy as far as I was concerned. My wife loved it. Try reading the book?
Yeah,
I think I probably...
In general, better than movies.
Yeah, I don't remember which one it was that I either... Maybe I did both. Anyhow, maybe I'm not being fair. Doesn't matter. I don't have to be fair. I'm a professor. Anyway, the main point, whether I'm fair or not, the main point is that people like Bly and Whitman are talking about this feminine quality that's coming back up in the collective mind and is exerting some influence. But what's in the unconscious collective, which is now the feminine rising, and what's in the conscious collective, which is the heroic myth, are not necessarily going to get along together. And that could be understood as one of the main religious problems of the late 20th century and certainly the early part of the 21st century, that there's this conflict. Now, it's all going to get worked out, because it always gets worked out. How does it get worked out? Well, for one thing, you have things like changes in science. Now, if there's anything that's patriarchal and masculine in its view of reality, it's science, right? It totally comes out of a worldview which is based upon consistency, objectivity, patriarchal structures. And if you even look at the way science is funded these days, it's totally patriarchal. I mean, they talk about big science and just all kinds of issues. I won't go into them, okay? Okay. But you have new sciences that arise at the same time as feminist spirituality are arising. Ecology, for example, which is the science of how everything connects to everything, is arising in the late 20th century and is going to become the most important of the sciences in the 21st century because of the physical mess we've made of the world because we didn't understand ecology. We call it global warming. We call it the pollution of the Pacific Ocean. We call it all these kinds of things in which we didn't understand how everything connects to everything. And we certainly didn't understand the darkness that we repressed, because we thought if you just stick it in the ground, it'll go away. And so now we have Hanford with millions of gallons of radioactive water and everything else polluting beyond repair, right? The aquifer, which flows into the Columbia River and everything downstream. We have Fukushima, right, which is, as we speak, spewing millions of gallons. Well, not as we speak millions, but between 300 and 450 tons of irradiated water in the Pacific Ocean every day, right? What kind of mentality is involved in creating a system that ignores its, quote, refuse? It's a system that doesn't understand where things go, doesn't understand things relating to each other, thinks if you stick it in the ground, it's gone, right? No goddess-oriented religion would think of such a thing because they understand the whole cycle. It's only a system of thought that sees what's above ground and ignores what's underground would think if you put all this pollution in the earth in Hanford, you can forget about it. How insane is this? Anyhow, these things are coming back. I'll get off my soapbox. I'm sorry. It's serious problems why I say it this way. This way of viewing things is coming back with the feminine. Systems theory, which is what underlies the whole cybernetic revolution and all our computers, systems theory is about whole systems. How do the parts relate to each other? I mean, as it manifests in computer science, you don't see it so clearly. But it came from cybernetic science after the Second World War, which understood whole systems and developed ideas like emergent properties which systems have that individual parts don't have. This is not patriarchal consciousness that thinks this way. This is a different kind of consciousness that thinks this way. This is all the feminist view of reality returning, but returning uncomfortably, not returning fully comfortably, because a lot of this is in conflict with a heroic story. Now, if you go to now, within that context, if you read Bly, I Came from the Mother Naked, and you read about the four faces of the mother, the four faces of the feminine, you understand in a different way the good mother and the death mother, the principle that creates and the principle that reabsorbs on the physical level, or the dancing mother, the ecstatic mother, and the tooth mother or the stone mother that absorbs mentally, that which creates mentally and that which destroys mentally. And the danger on that creative line is, as Bly says, dismemberment. Right? Why dismemberment? Because in the passion of creativity or in the passion of intoxication, wholeness can be lost. That's the danger. It's the downside or the dark side of return to the feminine, that the independence of the ego is lost, that the individual is torn apart, loses boundaries, loses wholeness. That's the dangerous side. And it's a danger for the hero, because the hero, as independent, is uncomfortable with it, doesn't play well with it, doesn't relate well to it. The hero is slaying the dragon. The hero isn't embracing the dragon. The hero is slaying the dragon. What would happen if the hero embraced the dragon? I mean, according to the story, right, there are all these bones thrown around, because presumably what's happened is you have heroes who weren't able to slay the dragon. The dragon ate the hero. That's what all the bones are that are around when St. George is rescuing the maiden. But what if the heroes, instead of running in there with a sword and a spear trying to kill the dragon, said, "Mom, I'm so glad to see you again." Would she have eaten them? Well, we don't know. We might find out in the 21st century, though. We might find out in the 21st century. That's a very different approach. There are no hero stories where the hero meets the dragon and deals with the dragon with love, at least not in the West. But we'll talk about the story of the Buddha and what happens when the Buddha meets the dragon. Something different happens. I'll tell you what the story is right now. We'll wrap the class up that way. One of the things you'll read about when you're reading Campbell is Campbell doesn't just talk about the story of Jesus as myth. He also talks about the story of Buddha as myth. Okay, so it doesn't mean that Jesus wasn't divine. It doesn't mean that Buddha wasn't enlightened. It just means there's a mythic aspect to these stories. And in the story of the Buddha, he sits down under the tree to meditate instead of getting crucified on it. He sits down under the tree to meditate. And what is he meditating on? He's meditating on the truth of his own nature. That's what the Buddha is trying to do, is discern what am I really. And in the process, Mara, who is the personification of all that dark stuff that we've talked about that's been split off, shows up, of course, because the Buddha is trying to become a whole person. So Mara shows up and, according to the myth, sends his armies at the Buddha because he doesn't want the Buddha to get free of the delusion of separation. Buddha is achieving the understanding of wholeness and oneness. And so the split off negative does a number of things, one of which is sends an army after the Buddha. And so the Buddha is sitting under this tree meditating peacefully, and on the horizon this army shows up with fire and swords and arrows, and all this stuff gets thrown at the Buddha, who's sitting there meditating. And the way the Buddha's stories show it is he's sitting there meditating and all the arrows that come at him turn to flowers, and the flowers fall on him. And all the fire that's thrown at him turns to flowers, and the flowers fall on him. And so on. It all turns to flowers, and the flowers fall on him. So why is this? It's because Buddha's sitting there and says, "Hi, Mom. We don't have to fight. We're all the same thing here, and it's all okay." So he doesn't get eaten. He's unlike St. George. He doesn't fight, and he's not like the bones of the ones who fought before him that didn't succeed in slaying the dragon. Yeah?
Have you seen Dragonheart?
A long time ago. I can't remember much about it.
Because he didn't kill the dragon, they actually made a deal.
Because what?
Pretty well together.
The what's that? Repeat?
The knight went to try to kill the last dragon, and instead of killing each other, because they kind of got at a stalemate, and then they made the deal to rip off everybody.
But they made a deal.
Mm-hmm. They made a deal to not kill each other because it's mutually preferable to have each other be alive.
And it's called Dragonheart?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I find it?
Netflix.
Netflix? Okay. I'll check out Dragonheart, although it doesn't sound very Buddhist. We make a deal to. It sounds more like Wall Street, actually.
Well, Sean Connery's the dragon, so.
Sean Connery's the dragon?
Mm-hmm.
It's a.
He's the voice of the dragon.
He's the voice of the dragon. So is it a movie or a cartoon?
It's a movie.
It's a movie, Dragonheart.
He's just a big animated dragon.
All right, I'll check it out.